WHP Radio. I want to welcome everybody to this week's episode of In the Rough with JB and Golfer Gal. I'm your host, JB, and while Golfer Gal filled in for me last week, this week she is on hiatus taking a break from the Morgan Cup that just finished. So what did I do? I found a great fill-in host, and this is Russ from Golf Tech. Russ, how are you?
I'm doing good, JB.
We are glad to have you on here because there's one thing that we've been discussing a lot on the forum, and that is something that I thought you would be great to bring on and discuss, and that is the myths in golf. And there's so many of them, but I wanted to get right to, you know, bring on an expert and kind of discuss a few of them that come to mind, and hopefully you'll be able to entertain us with these answers.
Perfect. Yeah, there's tons of myths out there. It's, you know, I hated mythology in high school, but boy, oh boy, when it comes to golf, there's a ton of them around.
Well, the first one that we've been discussing a lot, and we actually discussed quite a bit at the Morgan Cup this past week, is putting accuracy. Can you kind of, you know, discuss that a little bit?
Sure. I think when it comes to myths, the average golfer out there thinks they're a much better putter than they really are. They believe that they're actually really good, and we start tracking their stats here at Golf Tech quite a bit, and we find out that that's probably one of their weakest areas, not their strongest. For the amateur golfer, they are lucky if they're holding 50% of their putts from 3 feet, and the tour average is about 96%. So, I mean, they're giving up, out of 100 putts, they're missing them 46 times more than the tour pros are. And that's something that I think anybody could get better at. It doesn't take a special physical quality to be able to make a 3-foot putt. And if you're missing half of them from 3 feet, you're wasting a lot of strokes.
Do you believe that part of that is because, you know, at the weekend round with the guys or gals, that when it's 3 feet, they pick it up?
Definitely. Too many gimmies. And then when they play in that club championship in August or September, you know, at the end of the golf season, now all of a sudden they have to make that 3-footer, and it's got a little bit of left or right break, and they haven't putted one of those all summer long. Their nerves get a little bit tighter. They get a little anxious. They don't make the same stroke, and sure enough, they start missing a lot more than they're making.
Now, I won't get too off on a tangent, but one of the things that I've always had an issue with amateurs and putting is the putting stats that they keep, and that is the number of putts per round. And, you know, I know there's a correlation between that and what you shoot, but in my mind, and maybe it's smaller and more feeble than most, if you miss all your greens, you're going to have less putts per round.
If you're a good chipper, that's true. But what they found, and this is kind of a related statistic, is that, you know, the average tour pro's first putt, the length of that first putt, is somewhere between 20 and 25 feet. And they're hitting probably 12 to 13 greens around. The average amateur has the same length first putt, even though he may only hit 2 greens around. They just don't chip it very close. So they're still having a 20-footer, maybe a 25-footer for that first putt.
What do you think is the best way to work on this to, you know, do you think, you know, one of the things that I've tried to do, and I'm not going to make this about me, but one of the things that I've tried to do before my rounds is rather than, you know, you always see the guys out on the course and they go to the practice green before they're ready to tee off and they're dropping balls from 40 feet because they want to try to gauge speed. One of the things that I specifically work on is strictly putts inside of 10 feet. Do you think that's the best way?
I think that's a good way to start. I just recently participated and I played in the U.S. Senior Open at Inverness Club in Toledo, Ohio. So I got a chance to spend 5 or 6 days around some of the best, you know, players in the world. Some of the guys that have won more majors probably than anybody when you think about it. And when I watched them warming up, I saw a lot of them working on that. Matter of fact, I saw Corey Pavin on Saturday practice 6-footers for probably 15 minutes. The same exact 6-foot putt for 15 minutes, trying to work on not only his pace, but to get the ball rolling in the hole and get some confidence in those putts. One of the things I do a little differently is I practice those 3 to 4 footers, but instead of putting to the hole, I'll stick a white tee in the ground and actually putt to the tee to try and shrink my target. Because the smaller my target that I practice to, the better my odds are of making that 3-footer when I'm out in the golf course.
It's funny you say that. Recently, I was playing around with some people, and we went to our local course, which is Grand Cypress. And Jared Lyle was there working on his game before he teed off, and he was on the putting green, and they had done some work to the green on one of the sides, so there were no holes. They just had stakes, and the stakes were very thin. And I made the comment, I said, you know, I love to hear the ball hit the hole. It's something I like before my round. And Jared Lyle comes over and he says, you know, you'd be much better putter if you practiced on this all the time, and it's pretty much the same thing.
Exactly. the smaller your target that you pick or get used to aiming at, the more you focus on it, the better you're going to do. People who putt at the hole, our eyes tend to focus at the edges of the hole and not the center where it's rolling in. So if you're looking at the edges, you're going to roll the ball to the edge and you're going to miss a lot of putts.
Now, do you think that there's a certain drill that people could work on to make putting more fun? We get a lot that, well, practicing putting is boring, and while I don't agree, that's one of the things that people talk about the most. Is there something that they should do or try to do to make it a little more enjoyable?
Well, I think it depends on what their putting stats are. If they're having a lot of three putts, if they're taking, say, 38 to 40-some putts around, I would probably tell them to practice lagging putts from 30 feet and the three-footers. If they do just those two things for 5 minutes, 10 minutes before their round, they're probably going to eliminate some of those three putts. But then when you look at the better players, somebody who's trying to shoot maybe in the 70s, you know, that guy needs to be taking maybe 30 putts around. He needs to be one putting more. So he needs to be doing like you talked about, or she. They need to be spending time making those, you know, 3 to 10 footers, because those are the ones you're going to make for par, maybe an occasional birdie. They're going to really help you with your scoring.
Now, one of the things, and I guess we'll leave this topic and move to the next one on this thought, is one of the things we hear the most complained about when it comes to practicing putting is that the practice green is entirely different than the green on the course and what to do about that. And I always tell people the same thing. It's still putting. You're still putting the ball. And to keep working on that, and you will see the numbers come down, and you'll make more putts.
I agree. And I think that the quality of the practice putting greens relative to the golf course greens are probably getting much closer now than they were even 5-10 years ago. The agronomic practices that most of the courses use on a daily basis are keeping the course greens and the practice greens much closer together as far as their speed and their quality. Now, occasionally you might have those days where you go out and maybe they just, you know, aerified the greens on the golf course and the practice green is still smooth, or vice versa. But on the whole, I think if you're practicing a little bit on that practice green before you go out, you're not that much different. It's probably more of a, you know, you're losing your touch and you're not focusing as well on the golf course as you did on the practice green, and you don't think the course's greens are the same, but they probably are very close.
Now, switching gears, another myth that we hear a lot is that baseball and softball, more specifically baseball, will ruin your golf swing. People who grew up playing baseball or play it now currently, that they struggle with the golf swing. Can you kind of discuss that and why you think this became a myth?
Yeah, it's a huge myth. And I think it's partly because of the instruction that went on even when I started in the business, you know, 20, 30 years ago teaching. Everybody believed that a baseball swing was so different from the golf swing that it ruined your ability to swing at a golf ball and hit it. When in reality, now at Golf Tech, we've been able to measure what's happening in the golf swing using some sensors to see what your body really does. And the similarities are much more common between a baseball swing and the golf swing than there are dissimilarities, I would say. I think that when I get somebody who comes in and says they're a baseball player or even a softball player, I love it, because I know that's a student that's going to be able to learn and understand what I want them to do much quicker, because the swings are so similar, especially the rotational motion of the hips and the shoulders. There's a lot more hip turn in a baseball swing than people realize, and most people don't do that in their golf swing, and they need to. So it's definitely a myth that I would love to dispel and let people know that those two swings are very closely related. The difference, really, if there is a difference, there's just not much of a backswing in baseball, which is good for baseball, but in golf, we need the backswing. So if you just add a backswing and then you turn like a baseball swing, you're making a great golf swing.
Let me ask you a question that's a little off topic. It's related to this topic, but you just said it, in golf we need the backswing. Why is that? Why do we need the backswing? Why couldn't we start on the proper plane and swing through?
I think for two reasons. One, in baseball, you know, first of all, the pitcher is throwing the ball at you, so you've already got a tremendous amount of energy with the ball being thrown at you. Even if it's a high school or a softball, it's still coming at you anywhere from 20 to maybe 80 miles an hour of speed, which is energy. And just getting the bat on that is going to create speed going the opposite direction. In golf, the ball's static. It's not moving at all. So if we don't wind up or have a bit of a backswing to build some speed on the downswing, we're never going to hit the ball very far. You're just going to be pushing it down the fairway, and it's never going to go very far. So we need the backswing to store up energy to then release on the downswing, because we have a static, unmoving target, whereas a baseball or a tennis stroke where it's coming at you, you know, a high-speed tennis serve, if you just get your racket on the ball, it's going to get back over the net. If you do that in the golf swing, it's not going to go very far at all.
Makes perfect sense. Now, another myth that we talk about at length, I mean at length, is driver distance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what people actually drive the ball. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Huge myth. As a matter of fact, I did an interview just recently for a big amateur event that's going to be played out in South Carolina coming up at the end of this month, and that's what I talked about, a lot of it. At this year's Senior Open that I competed in, Olin Brown won the tournament, 15 under par, won by like 3 shots. Olin was in the top 10 in driving accuracy for fairways hit, greens in regulation, and least putts. He was 41st out of 60 players in driving distance. He was in the bottom third when it came to how far he hit the ball, and he won the tournament by 3 shots. So when I have a student that comes into me and says, hey, I need to hit the ball 20 yards farther, it would change my game, I'll try and give him what he wants, but I really know that he'd be much better off by learning to hit the ball a little straighter, learning to hit the greens a few more times, and putting a little bit better. Driving distance, if you look at it, really isn't going to make you play that much better unless you're already hitting the greens and putting on top of that.
And that makes perfect sense. And, you know, to relate that, we already know that people don't really know how far they hit the ball in general anyway. You know, we've seen the numbers all over the place that, you know, every guy on the internet apparently drives the ball 275 yards, and it's just not the case. But, you know, if you can keep it straighter, you're already ahead of the curve because you're getting more distance to begin with.
Ball's going to roll out farther in the fairway than it does in the rough. Plus, it's a much easier second shot to control and get the ball either on the green or close to the green at that point. I agree.
You know, I spent some time a couple of years ago, and I got a chance to talk with David Ledbetter, and he made a comment that 70% of iron shots into the green for amateur golfers that are between 125 and 160 yards out come up short. And I think that in some ways, and I'm going to get off on a little tangent here, but I think that relates to the driving distance thing, is when people talk about their distances, they say, okay, I hit a 7-iron X yards, but that could be when they hit it flush, and most of the time they don't get to that number. And it all goes back to the same thing. If you learn how to hit the ball correctly and you're hitting it to a specific number each time, you will score better.
Exactly. And I think relating to that point, what it comes back to, or what causes that, is that one drive the guy hit last summer, or maybe late fall when the fairways were running a little bit farther, that rolled out a little farther than normal, and he go, oh, I drove that one 270 yards. I can hit it 270 with my driver now. Or he hits that 6-iron one day that just hits perfectly flush and flies a little farther, and it gets on the green on that 170-yard par 3, and he goes, oh, my 6-iron now goes 170. When, in fact, what they need to know is what is the average distance they carry the ball, and that would be a more important number, because in reality, you know, that average 6-iron probably only carries 150. So if he's playing a par 3 that's 160 yards long with a bunker in front, he's thinking, oh, I can hit my 6-iron 170. I'll hit that here. And then he buries it in that bunker. He thinks he hit a bad shot, or the tee was wrong, or something was wrong with the yardage, when in fact he's not taking his average shot. He's taking his best shot he hit one time and thinking that's his normal shot, which it is not.
Well, and every amateur should listen to this, because this all comes back to pace of play and how to make your game more enjoyable as well as those around you. The next thing I want to discuss is another myth that we were actually talking about just yesterday on the golf course, and that is that the driver should be parallel to the ground at the top of the swing. We always hear the term by the big hitters, look at how far past parallel they are, and that the club should be parallel to the ground on your driver swing, but it's really just not the case for people, is it?
Exactly. I mean, you watch most of the tour pros, other than a few exceptions, and there always needs to be an exception to the rule. I mean, John Daly definitely goes past parallel, and he hits the ball a tremendously long distance all the time. But if you looked at every tour pro out there and counted how many of them got to parallel and how many of them were short of parallel, the numbers are staggering. Most of them are going to be well short of parallel with where the club shaft position is. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't make a full turn of their shoulders, but they did not let that club dip or move past parallel to the ground. That's just too hard to control.
Now, do you think that with the amateur swing, if they're trying to do that, what is the biggest issue they're going to come into?
Well, they're going to have an issue with consistency and contact, and even though they might create a couple of miles an hour more speed, if they don't hit the ball in the center of the club face, they're not getting ball speed. And when I work with students a lot, on drivers, we work more on their ball speed versus their club head speed, because it's ball speed that makes the ball fly. That's the physics of the game. It's how fast did you hit the ball, what angle did it take off on, and how many RPMs of backspin did you have. And there have been studies that can tell you, based on your ball speed, if you have 120 miles an hour ball speed, you need to launch it at exactly this angle of attack with exactly this many RPMs of backspin to maximize your distance. And what we find is that when you're making these big long swings, yes, you might get a little more club head speed, but it's not translating into ball speed because you didn't hit it solid. And because you didn't hit it solid, you're also getting the wrong backspin number and launch conditions. And the ball really doesn't go as far as it could at all. It's a very short, crooked shot instead of the longest drive you want.
That's, it all comes back to fitting as well, in the aspect of, you know, too much spin, too high launch, too low spin, and you are giving up yards on the course.
Exactly.
Now, this next topic that I wanted to address, and really the final myth that we can discuss here, is something that's so true to me, and I'll talk about the myth and then I'll give you a brief story. I'm doing finger quotes on the air, and I don't really know why, but it's the old saying of, if I know what's going on, I can fix it, and I don't need anybody else's help. And I took lessons, a couple of them as a kid, and then I played, golf as a kid, and then I gave it up for a number of years. But back then, I was a real student of the game. I followed swings and things like that. And when I came back to the game, I never took a lesson, and I was a decent golfer. I was, a 10 or a 12 handicap, and I played good golf, and I would feel something wrong. I was missing with my irons, and I'd either blame it on the equipment, which is, of course, what every amateur should do. It's always the equipment's fault. Don't ever forget that.
Exactly.
Or I would go to the range the next time, and I'd try to fix it or just assume it would go away. And then once I decided to go and sit down with a teacher and watch some stuff, and it wasn't the fear of, oh my God, they're going to rebuild my entire swing, because that's just not the case. And even though my swing doesn't look 100% conventional, when I was going through the impact zone, I was really in good shape. It was just one little minor tweak with my grip was all I needed. And it changed my game forever. So the whole idea of, I know what's wrong with it, it was completely false. And second of all, even if I did know, I can't fix it anyway until somebody is pointing it out to me. So
exactly.
Rather than me just keep rambling and rambling on about my own golf game and why that's so important, when you see this stuff, the I know what's going on, I can fix it, what are your first thoughts?
Well, my first thoughts are I'm a little saddened, because it means one of two things. Either I didn't do a good enough job of explaining to this person how I'm going to help coach them and make them better, or they're a little delusional. and I don't mean that in a bad way.
And still believe in lessons?
Can you? Yeah, I think so. Because here's the way I would describe to somebody. If I got a letter from the IRS saying I was going to be audited for my taxes from 2 years ago, I would much rather have a CPA going into that meeting with me than me sitting in there alone. Because the CPA knows a lot more about what's going on in that situation than I'm going to know. Even though I may know a lot about taxes, and I've, maybe I was a pretty good math student in school, I want a professional that knows exactly what is going on to the nth degree, the best person I could possibly find to help me through that situation. And that's what I'm supposed to do as a golf coach. If I see somebody's golf swing and maybe there's one thing wrong, maybe there's 10 things that need to be fixed. My job is to fix those things in the right order, and do the right drills to help that person learn the quickest. And I will say this, along that same lines, is that the I know I can fix it. I tell you what, a lot of that comes from is some of the magazines that are out there with their monthly periodicals that will have that tip for that month, and somebody will read that and say, oh, that's what I need to do. That's going to fix my golf game. And those are the guys that usually come to see me afterwards and say, okay, now I understand. I need to have somebody who's working just with me, fixing just what's wrong with my game to make me the best player I can be, not some generic tip, I can fix it because I'm a pretty smart guy. You can be a very intelligent person, but if you're not able to watch it, I probably have done, 20-some thousand golf lessons in my life. And if you've done something 20,000 times, you're more apt to fix something quicker and easier than somebody who's never really given a golf lesson or really hasn't looked at that many golf swings and then just guessing on, well, what do we fix and why and how do we fix it in the quickest, most efficient manner.
You know, it's funny you brought up the magazine tips, because I'll take it another thing. Based on and the magazine tips are there to help. They really are, and I don't want to dispel the thing that their facts and their tips are not good, but they're not the same as getting a lesson from a coach. It's just – it's not the same. Putting – you know, reading a magazine article and going to do it, it's just – they're two different things there. But, you know, we've seen all these tips, add 10 yards to your game, and – you know, the equipment companies say, you know, this driver is going to make you 10 yards longer. They've been going on for 20-something years saying the same thing. At this case, and while technology's gotten a lot better, don't let anybody fool you and say that the clubs aren't going longer than they used to, because they are. But at the current pace of between the equipment being 10 yards longer and the tips giving us 10 yards longer, we should all be hitting it 1,000 yards off the tee.
Definitely, and it is better. The equipment is much better. As a matter of fact, I think my last year that I played tour events in the 80s, I think I averaged about 255 off the tee with my driver, and the last two times I played in tour events recently at 55 years old, I'm averaging between 270 and 280, and I guarantee you I'm not stronger and younger and more flexible than I was when I was in my 20s. It's the equipment that helps me hit the ball farther now. But you're right, exactly it. The tips that we see are good, and they are well-intentioned, but just because it's the perfect tip, it doesn't mean it's the perfect tip for each individual person that may be looking at it.
You know,
somebody might read it, and it doesn't apply to them even.
It's funny you say that, because I always thought that my biggest miss was I played a cut off the tee, and my biggest miss was a slice, like many, many amateur golfers. And I always thought, I just assumed that I was coming over the top, because that's such a common miss.
Exactly.
And it turned out it wasn't that at all. It was a minor grip change that I needed, because it was keeping me open. And while I do come over the top every now and then, that wasn't really my issue. And I had tried to address the over-the-top swing for a decade and couldn't do it, because it wasn't my problem.
Exactly. And again, going back to what I saw at Inverness Club at the U.S. Senior Open this year, I spent about a half a day watching some of the top players that have ever played the game. There was Nick Price was there, Tom Kite, Tom Pertzer, Jay Haas, some of the best ball strikers that have ever played the game, were all working on the same thing. They were trying to get a little steeper and almost feel like they were swinging outside to in through impact with their irons, because that got them on top of the ball, compressing the ball, and controlling the flight better. And the better you control your flight, the more consistent your distance is going to be, which is obviously very important to a tour pro. So it's the exact opposite of what I might teach to a 25 handicapper who's fighting a slice, but it's what the tour pros are working on. So just because a tour pro is doing that, does that mean we should be teaching that to a 20 handicapper with a slice? Probably not. That'd be a myth that I would want to dispel and not try and perpetuate, that it would help him play better golf to swing it like Nick Price. It probably wouldn't. Does that mean Nick's doing something wrong? No, Nick's doing the perfect swing for Nick Price or Jay Haas or Tom Kite, but not for, you know, Tom Smith, who's a 25 handicapper fighting a 20-yard slice.
You know, it's fascinating, and all the golf myths are fascinating. You know, we're running out of time this week, so I want to thank Russ from Golf Tech for coming on and talking about this. This is just an awesome subject that I definitely want to have you come back on again and discuss, because there's just so many of them out there. I could sit here all day and rattle them off with you, and believe between you and I, I've believed in most of them. I mean, that's just the way it is. But I always love bringing experts on, talking about it and everything else. So we want to thank Russ for coming on, and we look forward to having you on the show again, if that's okay with you.
I'd love to, JB. Thanks a lot. I had a great time.
And for myself and the empty chair of Golfer Gal this week, that is it. We will be back next week with an all-new show.